Not for myself alone, like I'm not being a selfish guy. You know what I'm saying? I won't eat the cake alone. That's it. You said that like when Nadine again and I eat the cake, I mean I get the message which bring back a birthday cake piece. That's it.
You're listening to CKUT. The following programming is taken from CKUT's Time Capsule Archives. For more from our 35 years of freeform broadcasting, visit our website at ckut.ca.
To Expo 67, just in time to we'll be here for the following year, where a number of very important individuals will come and manifest and speak of black power, of liberation philosophies, both on the left and extreme lefts, about Pan-Africanisms, both culturally and politically. Last train to bring us to 1968 and the topic of a conference happening in Montreal, Protest and Pedagogy, as you just heard, looking 50 years back to the occupation of the computer room at the Sir George Williams campus, now Concordia, by students, many of them from the Caribbean, and militating against, well, universities and academic systemic racisms and biases, to explore that in a much deeper fashion and knowing much more than I is our guest, Kai Kalau. We're a much admired poet, organizer, and performer, especially on this show. One of the best shows I've seen in a number of years in Montreal recently, when you did a set before Wadada Leo Smith, his Liberation Suite, and you had done the collaborative piece on, what was it, the transcripts of interviews at borders and Homeland Security kind of stuff?
Yeah, well, you know, first I have to say thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure, and that was a wicked introduction you did. Where did you find the Expo 67?
Oh, that's a classic track. I actually had to go through my an old hard drive. I couldn't find the 45, but I did find it. And there's different versions of it, but I had to play that.
Because it made me think that, you know, some of the people, some of the students who came from the Caribbean on arriving in Montreal were probably arriving with a sense of hopefulness and a gaze directed toward the future, right?
Yep.
And what they couldn't anticipate, I guess, was that they were coming into a society that was in the grip of a lot of social strife, and where prejudice was also very active, not only in the streets, but in the institutions, and that they would have to contend with both of those things. So there would be the uprising of the FLQ, and there would be the movement for Quebec liberation that would kind of grip Montreal during that period. And then there would be the discrimination that the students later faced and wound up contesting in 1968 and 1969. Yeah. So that song that you played really made me think of sort of the optimism of that period, in a way that was only partly, I would say, darkened by some of the obstacles that those students faced, because those students still, you know, you were talking about Afrofuturism, and my co-organizer Nalini Mohabir and another one is Ronald Cummings, who's in St. Catharines, Ontario. Nalini is down at Concordia right now, hosting some events, but Nalini is very fond of saying that the occupation happened in the same year that a man landed on the moon, and that it was symbolic that the students occupied the computer center. They did not occupy a hallway or the administration building. They occupied the computer center, and in a sense, occupying the idea of a future, and the possibility of a future. And so with this series of events, in a sense, we're trying to duplicate that. The events have started on January 29th, mm-hmm. which was the first day of the occupation in 1969, and they'll end on February 11th, which was the final day of the occupation when the students were arrested. And we wanted to mirror that, and because it's 50 years later, which is a nice big round number, we wanted to, in our own way, occupy the university with thinking about the 50th, with our presence, with our thoughts, with our solidarity among different communities, with artwork as well. There is an archival exhibit that spans the duration of the conference and event series. To make a point also that these are very important events. These are events that shook the Caribbean community here in Montreal and internationally as well. And I can talk a little bit about some of those resonances in a moment, but we really wanted to emphasize the importance and the resonance of those events with this event series. So that's why it kind of spans that duration. And all the events are happening.
The actual occupation period.
Yes. Yeah.
Which led, I mean, just, we can talk about, because these events, it's conferences, it's roundtables, it's screenings, it's mm-hmm. it's explorations. There's a lot of sharing during this period that runs till the 11th of February. The event itself starts with an occupation of the computer room. And was there a manifesto? Was it just part of a number of initiatives and concerns, or was there an actual, we're here for the following reason?
Well, not being an accredited historian myself, more what I can say, what I do know about the events is I've been in conversation with a number of people who were there at the time. One, Dr. Rodney John, who's a fascinating man. And he was among the students who came here to with the aim of getting into medical school. And the biology course that he found himself in with a number of the other students who wound up becoming the original complainants was the course of a man named Dr. Perry Anderson, Professor Perry Anderson. And that biology course was a prerequisite for medical school. That's why they were in that course. And they found that there was unusual and unequal treatment by the professor. And a couple of experiments were conducted. I think one in which a West Indian student, it was known that there was that Anderson didn't like West Indians. That's what people said. And so one experiment was conducted where some West Indian students had submitted a paper and received a grade, and they got a white student to submit the exact same paper, and it received a superior grade. And the students did their best to exhaust every possibility of getting a fair inquiry and a fair hearing. And they found themselves stymied at every turn. And the occupation of the computer center was sort of the final, option in their process.
And then it ends with the arrests of a number of the...
It does. It ends before that, actually. It descends toward its end with a mysterious arson.
Oh, yes.
Pardon me. That was lit. And I had seen the floor plans of the ninth floor. It's been totally renovated, right? This took place on the ninth floor of the hall building. It's been totally renovated now, but in the past, it's interesting because nobody knows who lit the fire. The students were accused of it. The students say that the police lit the fire, and nobody really claims responsibility for it, right? But interestingly, when you look at the floor plans, one of the things that you notice is that the fire was lit in a specific location that would have cut off the only other exit route from the place that the students were occupying. So they had to go in the opposite direction, and the police happened to be conveniently stationed right there. So one wonders what circumstances
led to
the fire
is the responsible.
Yes.
So it's West Indian students for the most part.
Well, there are a lot of there were a lot of white students, Jewish students. We spoke to a man the other day who was at the launch named Michael Cohen, who was one of the students who was present and active at that time. So there was an interestingly a mix of students. There were some students from the English and some from the French Caribbean as well. So it was a fairly diverse group of students.
Our guest in studio is Kai Kalau. He is one of the organizers of this protest and pedagogy conference, and as you just heard, which commemorates and looks back 50 years to the occupation of the computer room by student protesters against discriminatory marking schemes and opportunities. We'll be back right after this to talk a little bit more about some of these activities and the background to this conference on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is Andre Tanker, and this would have captured some of the themes and some of the thinkers as well who from the West Indians traveled the world, or like C.A.L.R. James. So this is thinking about him and, those West Indian students, immigrants who've built this country and also the Caribbean. On CKUT 90.3 FM, the Mansa Musa Drummers.
right away, looking for another home. Try to run away, run away from my destiny. In another world, a world that was strange to me. Trying to change myself, change my identity. But strong is the power of love and the power of freedom and the power of blackness fills my heart, yeah. But strong is the power of love and the power of freedom and the power of blackness fills my heart, yeah.
Of you know, that was a heady time. You mentioned it. There's a sovereigntist movement, the Quiet yeah. Revolution just here. You have basically this new generation of students emerging out of a newly independent West Indian nations, mm-hmm. French and English territory still occupied, but it's, you know, Pan-Africanism.
Yeah,
the African independence movements that are ongoing, whether it be, you know, the apartheid regime in South Africa, uh-huh. There's many influences. There was a reason for occupying the space because they weren't heard upon what was perceived or grievances that were perceived structural and personal discriminatory practices in the classrooms mm-hmm. and the academia. But there was a lot more going on.
There was. I mean, you know, I just listening to that track, one of the things that I thought about is, you know, as the occupation happened in January, February 1969, but 69, 70, 71, you have this turn in Jamaican music going from rocksteady into reggae, and the sound becomes, in some ways, more assertive, perhaps. And you have the Black Power era happening. You have a variety of countries in the Caribbean achieving independence. So, as we were just saying, Trinidad and Jamaica in 1962, and Guyana and Barbados, I think, in 66. And you have Paris 68. You have, in 1968, the Black Writers' Congress that brought a lot of radical thinkers to Montreal. And so it was, and also, of course, October 1970, the October crisis. So this was a very heady time and a radical moment, a moment where people were agitating for self-determination, equal rights, justice, recognition, for the recognition of their humanity and the ability to, as Vox Sambu put it earlier, live peacefully. Sometimes I would like to return to, in a way, just to visit briefly, you know,
inspiration,
just to catch the vibe. Yeah.
Just a whiff.
Uh-huh. You know, what we've tried to do is try to be very much inspired by that moment and by that headiness and try to recreate some of that in a way, some of that, that, emotional and intellectual and radical bubbling, and to do that by having film screenings along with Cinema Politica. There's one this afternoon from 4 to 6 p.m. And today is February
2nd.
Sugarcane Alley, Rue Cazeneigre. It's a screening with Cinema Politica, and it is from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Deceve Cinema in Concordia. There will be a talk back with Emily Zobel Marshall and Océane Jessor. Emily Zobel Marshall is from Leeds Beckett University. Océane Jessor is from Concordia University. And they will be discussing the film afterwards, which I'm told was I'm not on intimate terms with that film, but I'm told it was a very influential film when it came out. And you know, aside from film screens, we have a lot of different panels and roundtables discussions about things like gender in activism in the 1960s, and policing in Black communities in Montreal, about the multidimensionality of Black experiences in Montreal. We have workshops on oral history and on other artistic practices and activities led by very accomplished artists, Pascal Anual, Charmaine Lurch, and then the conference. We have the conference, which is on the 8th and 9th at Concordia. And if you visit the website, it's protestsandpedagogy.ca. That's protestsandpedagogy.ca. You can get a list of all of the events. We have our calendar there. You can click on each event, and what will open up is a kind of expanded sort of informative page about the event and the participants. And I would really encourage people to come because, you know, this, interestingly, the media in Quebec has been, and in Canada, has been picking up on the fact that it is the 50th. People have been writing about it and talking about it. And although I haven't studied all of the articles that have been written, a number of them have gotten at least one part right, which is that this was probably one of the largest and most important student protests in national history. And it's probably one of the most important Black radical events in Canadian history, if not the, you know, flagship one. There is some popular recognition of that, particularly in the media, which is very welcome because many have anticipated the October crisis. And had international resonance. They had resonance in the Caribbean.
There were real consequences of what happened.
There were real consequences
on governments in Trinidad and how things were handled.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, one thing that I'd been talking to Pat Dillon about was that I'm from Western Canada. My mom was here at that time. And so she has a memory of that time. She actually came 1 year later in 1970. She has a memory of what it felt like to be a newly arrived student from the Caribbean at that time. And I grew up in Western Canada, and I grew up and at some point gained some kind of awareness of these events through her. To say that these events have traveled across Canada, people who have a connection to them live in places as far as Vancouver, Halifax, they live in the States, they live in the UK. So these events do have international and generational resonance. And it's very important that we recognize that and that we commemorate that.
There's two things, because we can spend there's a long conference over the occupation period. We're going until the 11th of February. So quite a lot of events and different ways of looking at both the event, the issues underlying it, but also its consequences and how some of those same concerns might also be reflected today. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I was very interested in kind of, working on Afrofuturism, but also knowing that this conference was happening and looking at some things that I did not know the event, I know of it, but not in any sense of depth. I mean, there have been people here at CKUT over the years who have done great work on that subject. I just wanted to tell people that on your website you have a very, very resources, which I found very, very interesting. So if people are interested and the events also are essentially free for the most
they're all free. Yeah.
So that's also another important element about this conference and what you're trying to do with it. But I did want to talk about two things. One of them was this, as you say, it was almost overshadowed in the context of looking back historically, the October crisis a year and a half later after the occupation, but you say it's a precursor. I was wondering, though, it's a heady time. There's many different kinds of resistance movements, revendications happening in Quebec, in Canada, and around the world, mm-hmm. whether you're black or you're not. Was there some kind of communication between that sovereigntist movement in Quebec and what was happening in terms of the occupation and the concerns that were there between, for example, the presence of a Stokely Carmichael who comes to speak about black power, C.L.R. James at the Writers' Conference, but who also comes back and speaks about black power as such, and you have a kind of an equivalent manifest in the sovereignist movement. Did they communicate?
The night of the launch, we had this. So one of the things that we've been doing is going into the Concordia archives and looking at and copying out a lot of photos from the period. And just as a side note, a lot of the photos are fascinating because they're photos of the property damage and they're photos taken by insurance company photographers to catalog and measure the extent of the damage. So they're actually superb photos. They're very clear and very precise. To answer your question, one of the photos that we had a banner of this long, narrow image of students leaning out a sequence of windows on perhaps the ninth floor of the hall building. So, you know, those white kind of windows with the rounded edges that they have on the hall building. And one of the original protesters, a man named Philippe Fils-Aimé, who was there, pointed to a student who was leaning out the window and said, "That photograph is of," and then he named this person. And apparently that person is one of the very prominent militants in the FLQ at the time. And he was there with the students. So I don't know the extent of what the connection might have been, but apparently there was something.
I'd be interested to explore that, the relationships between these two kinds of power movements or identity movements, very concrete revolutionary movements.
Yeah.
The other thing that I wanted to just explore with you, because I think it's very explicit in some of the workshops or round tables before we take, is that there's different approaches to the extent and the significance both of the event and the ideas that were being discussed at the time. Whether it was, you know, the aesthetics of such politics, mm-hmm. about writing, about West Indian writings, mm-hmm. with a guy like C.L.R. James, who'd been militating since the 1920s on the very subject, on the use of words and what counted as a legitimate academic studies, therefore, you know, black vernacular and all those kinds of issues. How is the conference addressing some of those, like the aesthetic elements, the expressive elements that are behind that, for example, the view on literature or critical theory? Or, I don't know, because I did see in the lineup that there were attempts to look at how the aesthetic qualities of manifestation and protestation, mm-hmm. might be taken on or seen through the lens of the event.
We have during the conference, Nalini was saying that was kind of emphasizing the same point as you, which is that the literature of black liberation, whether it was essay format, prose, poetry, that was very important at the time, and we wanted to kind of reflect that as well. So there are two poetry readings to close off each day of the conference, to also, I guess, emphasize an engagement with language, an engagement with literature, and to emphasize its centrality in advocating for black liberation. And part of the archival exhibit also involves art from a variety of of Caribbean artists. So there's art from Charmaine Lurch that's up, from Leon Llewellyn, who is an incredible painter from that time. Carlisle Williams and a number of others, interspersed with archival photos from Concordia at the time and from Montreal at the time, and large grand format printed banners of the student newspapers and other papers, black community papers as well. And all of that is available in the space where most of the events are taking place, which is called Fourth Space. And it's on the main floor. If some of you remember where the Concordia bookstore used to be, on the main floor there, the bookstore is now underground. And on the main floor is this multimedia exhibition space called Fourth Space. And it's right there in the library building, right on de Maisonneuve Street, with these beautiful giant windows and these industrial beams. It's actually a gorgeous space. I have to shout them out and thank them. And I would also like to say, while we're at it, that we have had some very supportive volunteers who've helped us put things together and support the conference. And large contributors and community contributors as well. We're very grateful for everyone's contribution. We have a partners page on the website where you can go to see who has contributed and who has supported. And that's where we're thanking people. So we do thank everyone who's contributed for their support. And it is very much heartening that these events have had so much support from the community, and that we have we've been able to work collaboratively for this kind of duration.
Our guest on the Mothership Connection, Funky Revolutions, and organizer from Protest and Pedagogy. If you're looking to look at their website, very interesting, with a great bibliography, lots of events running till the 11th of February. Kai Kalau, our local, one of our admired poets and also organizer, will be back after this in reflection of some of the sounds and, influences that would have been behind the young students. This is, in fact, also one of the immigrant groups that would have been coming at the time to Canada, especially into the 1970s, from Ghana. Anyways, this is E.C. Arinze and his music, Lumumba Calypso, on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Man, what have you to say about the death of Lumumba? Man, what have you to say about the death of Lumumba? Well, we don't like it. That is what the people say. We don't want it. That is what the public say. But please, something must be done. The same could happen to anyone. The first prime minister of Congoland, a brave and strong leader, he brought freedom to Congoland. But his political opponents strongly opposed his leadership. He was beaten up, arrested and sent to prison yard. So Lumumba, a prime minister, was humiliated before the world. Captured, imprisoned by the men who were against him. Then what we had again were the brutal sufferings of Lumumba. And suddenly the news broke out that Lumumba escaped from prison yard. You know, the whole world was shocked. Some hardly believed I could get away. But then it was understood. It was a plot of Lumumba's death. Dead.
said his political enemies are all happy. Now is the time for them to solve this problem in Congo land. The body of Patrice Lumumba, they bluntly refused to give away. The family of Patrice Lumumba, they couldn't see him back again. May his soul rest in peace, but his conspirators must be punished.
For those students who would have had the courage to occupy a space, computer space, at then Sir George Williams University campus in downtown Montreal. Started on the 29th of January, running till the 11th of February, free events. If you're just interested in checking out, they have a website, but just put in protest and pedagogy Concordia, and you'll get to an excellent, actually, the programming and as well a wonderful bibliography on this. And it's been a very interesting kind of side experience for myself, preparing for today's program, just looking at some of the work of the influences and reading some of the speeches that people like Stokely Carmichael, who were in Montreal at the time, would have been giving repeating in various places. C.L.R. James giving speeches about Black Power in 1968 in London to West Indian student associations in Scotland and across this country. Our guest Kai Kalau was one of the organizers, and we've been looking at some of the events and background to the event and what it might mean for us today. And then we just heard Senior Soul with Is It Because I'm Black, which was pretty much the question that the students were asking when no one would listen to the unfair marking and teaching processes that they were experiencing, especially in particular in certain classes. So the event, why did you feel personally invested? I know that, you know, your mother came in and knows the vibe. It has the reflection with the West Indian community at large, here but also back, entre guillemets, at home for mm-hmm. some of the people who are arriving here. A very important period of immigration from the West Indies happening at that time and into the early 70s. But in, as a novelist or as a poet or a performer, why did you feel invested in organizing and helping organize this event?
Well, I mean, I have to say that the organizing came about because last year I was at Concordia and I was hanging out with two friends, close friends, Nalini Muhabir and Ronald Cummings, and we almost all three of us blurted at the same time that next year it's going to be the 50th of the, as they say, the Sir George Williams quote-unquote affair, and we thought we wanted to do something to mark that. And, you know, I think that I have a, I grew up in sort of, when it comes to Black Canadian culture and Caribbean Canadian culture, I grew up on the margins, in the periphery, Western Canada, where there are West Indians, but it's a small, there's small communities. There's a presence nonetheless, right? But it's outside of major centers of Caribbean culture, Caribbean Canadian culture, like Toronto and Montreal as well. And growing up on the periphery like that, there is one of the issues that you consistently face is that outside of your family and your small community, there's no reflection of you in the culture at large. And that is just devastating in a way, because you become minimized and disrespected so easily because your culture has no presence. And coming to Montreal, these events of 1969 were some of the first events that, once I learned about them, really began to resonate with me, because they marked a moment when many Black Caribbean Canadians put their foot down and said, we are here, we exist, we're brilliant, we demand our rights and justice. And that, for me, I always seen that as, see that, and I've always seen that as a moment of self-determination, coming into being. And so for me, that's a crucial moment in the Caribbean Canadian experience. It's a fascinating moment, what happened and the way it happened and how high the stakes were and how devastating the consequences. You know, and I have a personal connection to it too, because my mom was here at that time. And so I've always sort of investigated and gravitated to that moment. And I see myself being born in the 70s as almost a direct outgrowth of a moment like that. That's how I would kind of encapsulate my thinking about my connection to the events and wanting to organize around them. But also, I mean, just a fascination with the events and with what happened. They were complicated events at a major institution in a very radical time. So
My approach to thinking about the event itself and some of the issues, but also placing it a little historically, very parceled out, mm-hmm. let's say, very, not in depth. But it was looking a little bit at C.L.R. James, you know, and I've heard a number of people here at this station talk about him before. And but I spent a little more time the last few weeks listening, reading others talking about him, about his work, but from so many different perspectives. And he would have been here around that time in Montreal. He would have given speeches across Canada. And I found that as a character to kind of historically situate the event, a really fascinating guy. But a man who reflects many generations, or I mean, born in 1901, dies in 1989, and fascinated by his literary start in the Caribbean, in Trinidad, and arguing with other writers of the white Creole class about the legitimacy of what I would say Creole vernacular, Creole writing, Creole expression. within Trinidad, and then this journey going to London, illegally in the United States, imprisoned in Ellis Island, working with sharecroppers, being a Trotskyist and then a Leninist, being a Pan-Africanist, knowing personally some of the great African-American writers of the diaspora, African writers of the diaspora, political leaders, a two-decade-long friendship with Richard Wright, and a man who wanted to express politics, social change, and consciousness through literary forms, and even said that West Indian literary forms would help transform and contribute to a new evolution in the English language. I found it really fascinating just to see this event through, like, all right, let's go follow CLR James. And just a lifelong journey you could do with this huge figure, but because of he didn't follow an academic model, because he didn't follow the traditional publications, because he was contrarian within West Indies culture and then spoke to a younger, more radicalized generation in the 1960s, I was interested, as you as a novelist and as a poet, how you see words and struggle. You're for yourself. Because some of your work is explicitly involved in speaking about situations, if nothing, if not expressly about identities in some cases, you know. But your work, you're there. I mean, that's what you... Not only, that's not what I'm saying, but it's there. It resonates.
Right.
Yeah. It's one of the reasons I like your work.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That's right. And thank you for saying what you did about the Wadada Leo Smith show at the top of our discussion. That was a show where I had sort of crowdsourced, in a way, the material for that. So I had asked people, I don't remember exactly what was going on at the time politically, but I think it around or before the time when, refugees started turning up and trying to cross the border on foot. But one of the things that we started, that I had crowdsourced information about, was I asked people about their experiences at borders, being stopped at borders, being interrogated in airports and points of ingress and egress from, you know, different countries, border crossings. And we took those and created a sort of piece called Interro. And the piece was, it was intended to be entirely in the interrogative mode. So everything was going to be a question. Because one of the things that at the same time I also found happening on social media was that, you know, let's say that you made a comment about something, like you just threw an offhand comment out there about, the police in Montreal are racist sometimes. And the first person to argue with you might say, where's your evidence for that? Show me the statistics. And even that simple act of posing a question can be the most destabilizing act. Because even if you have no duty to account to this person who is posing, who's flinging some question at you from his couch or his keyboard, you feel somehow initially obliged to do that, right? And when you're questioned at border crossings, when you're questioned by police, just those simple questions can be so destabilizing and so difficult that we thought doing a show that was entirely in the interrogative mode with these aggressive questions would have that effect on the audience. Naturally, we wound up later thinking that it was actually conceptually more interesting once some answers were involved, too, so there was a back and forth. But in terms of my own work, yeah, I mean, I try to access a language that's engaged with the things that are going on in the world around us, the things that people actually experience, and then to not just present it flatly, but give it some kind of an aesthetic treatment, to transform it somehow into something that is not just reportage, but allows you to sail through the moment in a way and observe it, but also be affected by it. Yeah.
Our guest on Funky Revolutions, Kai Kalau, organizer, and we've been speaking essentially about this event marking the 50th anniversary of the student occupation of the computer room at the old Concordia, Sir George Williams. Check out Protest and Pedagogy at Concordia, some really interesting events, films, performances, readings. Yeah. But you, as an artist, I mentioned this piece I really did admire. But you have some new project coming up, and I thought Magnetic Equator, March 26, 2019.
Yeah, it's a new book, and it takes it takes place sort of drifting between Western Canada and Guyana, which is where my mom's family's from. I grew up in Western Canada, and it gets pulled to Montreal in moments, but it's also about that sort of sense of distance and dislocation that's always there if you are, say, an immigrant or a migrant, or even if you're first gen, born in one place, but you have ties to this other place. And it's really inhabited by that sense of never being able to be in one place completely. You know, like if you grow up in Montreal, but you have roots in Gonaïves, you can identify with this place, but up to a point, because you're also identifying with another place. And you might go to Gonaïves and then realize when you're there that you're aching or longing for some of your familiar friends, familiar sights, familiar, you know, situations that you would see in Montreal. And it's about that sense of drift, of kind of diasporan drift. And that really underlies it. And I also think, you know, that what we were talking about too, about the young students who came from the West Indies in the 60s, I'm certain that they must have experienced something like that. And it's also been one of my, up to this point, my throughout my 20s, 30s, and 40s, it's been a focus of mine to interrogate that sort of experience, that experience of being between places, being in but not necessarily of one place, always. And that is also part of the interest that has carried me to look at the Sir George Williams protests, along with my co-organizers. So, yeah. But we're having a... Once again, there's a film screening tonight, 4 to 6, Rue Casnègre, Sugarcane Alley. It's at the Deceve Cinema, the big one in the library at Concordia, big, comfortable cinema, nice and warm. So come down if you can.
Check out the website as well, Protest and Pedagogy at Concordia. Thank you very much, Kai.
Thank you, Khaled. It's been a pleasure.
And a new publication coming out in March of this year, Magnetic Equator. My name is Khaled. We'll be back right after this. And I guess for the next half hour, I tried to find music that was like... Man, they're on the cusp, 1968, 69, you're on the cusp of the great reggae revolution, uh-huh. But it's not quite there yet. All of the great word power stuff is about to happen, yes. With Gil Scott and The Last Poets. It's just beginning. Mm-hmm. It's just beginning. So I had to go and really find what were the songs in 1968 that these guys may have heard, brought with them, or heard in some of the clubs where some of these performers would have made their music. It could be the BC Rhythm Combo. That's what we'll play in the next half hour. Starting with a cheat, though. This is South African Enlistment, the Abyssinians, on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Coming, yes, I'm coming. gold are gold from the south of Africa. Enslaved the bold, control their souls.
Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio. From drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between, professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, the island also known as Dorjage in the Ganyagaha language and Munuyang in Anishinaabemowin, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah Day, live in studio on Thursday, May 4th, 2023. It's a moody looking evening out. We are in store for a couple of sunny days ahead of us. Perfect weather. Oh, it's always perfect weather for going to the theater, in my opinion. We have lots of things coming up this weekend I'll tell you about. But for tonight's show, a little look at the guests this evening. The Bloody Tale of Lizzie Borden in musical format. In the Wings production presents the Quebec debut of Lizzie the Musical at Théâtre La Comédie de Montréal. I'll speak with one of the producers and performers at the top of the hour. Then, an immersive piece that puts you in a childlike garden world. Yes, you get to be the rock in Au Jardin des Potiniers at La Chapelle. And community theater is making a gradual return. Lakeshore Players Dorval, in their 58th year, they are presenting a romantic comedy that involves a writer, a starstruck writer, and a very famous celebrity in As Bees and Honey Drown. And also, it is the return of Sketchfest, the 16th edition launches tonight, and we'll speak with the director before the end of the hour. Now, there are some really cool things you can check out this weekend. Prayer for the French Republic continues at the Siegel Center. The aforementioned shows, Sketchfest, is this weekend and next. Lizzie the Musical launches on Saturday evening. And Ronnie Burkett's spin on William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, Little Willie, is at Centaur until May 14th. I caught the second preview last night. It's amazing. This is the Marionette Show, where he's one performer on stage. There is a lot of audience interaction, but Ronnie's basically working with a cast of dozens of different marionettes, and all of his favorite crowd favorites are back, like Edna Royal and Esme Massengill, these really intricate, funny little characters that he's developed over the past decade, and they put on Romeo and Juliet, and it's hysterical. So check that out. It's also very, very, very